accession number 11261, reel 7.
Dr. Pruvolovich, reel 7.
Found you nice where I was. I was stumbling across between the tents, and somebody was mumbling something from underneath one of the tents. What's going on? What's happening? And somebody shouting at him, "Oh, you're having nightmares or whatever it is. Keep quiet." I presumed his guard commander, whoever it was. Anyway, I managed to get to the end of that encampment, and there was a path there. And I went one way, and somebody stopped me there. I realized there was a guard there. I turned the other way, there was another guard. There was barbed wire on that side, so there was the camp on that side. So what to do now? I realized why neither of them shot, because they could have killed, you know, their comrade at the opposite end. I was right in the middle there. So anyway, somehow I managed to sort of fight my way through that barbed wire and tumble down into a ravine. And there was the day breaking out. It was becoming quite clear. And I find myself in a terraced vineyard, you know, sort of all in layers, you know, like the Italians are, you know, sort of every a couple of yards. And there, again, something that taught me, and I sort of broke off a few branches from a tree. This plant, you know, that it's poisonous. I got it.
Laburnum,
yes, that's right. I broke off some of these, took with me, and I had no chance. I had to lie in between the rows of, you know, vine. That whole day, which was a scorching Italian sun, I had some water with me, but of course it was hot, and it was very hot water. Anyway, as you can see, I have to clear my throat quite often. Well, I had to lie there more or less lifeless whole day and not make a move. And sometime in the afternoon, two of Tito's patrols passed by, two steps down, or two rows down. Again, they didn't see me. I was, you know, trying to make myself as invisible as possible. Anyway, they passed by. I survived that. So I came down to the river bank. I spent the day, the following day, in this cave. I came down again towards the end of the day. There was a cherry tree there. And I thought, well, I'll go and get a few cherries, you know. As I was up the tree, somebody came, you know, and asked me what I was doing there. And I said, well, I come to take a few cherries, I'm hungry and all that. So I said, well, all right, we'll carry on. It turned out to be the owner. I said, I'm hungry, and you know, he didn't seem to mind. But I said, I was looking for some food. He said, my house is there, just, you know, around the corner. My wife is just making some bread. If you go there, you know, I'm sure she'll give you some. Again, being naive as it is, I mean, desperate as well, you say, well, all right, I will accept anybody in good faith. I went there. I had a tin with me, you know, a tin of meat, which I hadn't been able to open for days because I had no tin opener, so I had to hit on a stone and, you know, and drink a bit of juice, you know, occasionally. But anyway, so I got some bread and I was sitting there eating it. In the meantime, this chap had gone to the partisan station, which was not far from there, and informed them that there was some strange fella around there. And as I was eating, the door opened and he came in, and this partisan, armed to his teeth, came in. So it was, among other things, I had my documents with me. I had some important insignia which I wanted to keep. I mean, I didn't want to part with them, you know, until I had to, which would have identified me straight away. And I had a hand grenade in my pocket as well. Again, he asked me, have you got any weapons? I said, no. But it was there, you know, one of those that played an important role later. Anyway, he stayed there for some time. We talked about it, and, you know, where I came from and what I've been doing and so on. And I said, right, you finish what you're eating and then we'll go to our station, which is not far from here, and we'll see, you know, so after we have interrogated you, you know, probably tomorrow you'll go to your hometown, and, you know, that would be it. Because I knew what it would come to anyway. So as he was taking me from there to the station, which was 200 or 300 yards away, I had to decide whether to make another go for it. And this hand grenade was in this pocket, and I had to transfer. I'm left-handed, so I mean, I could transfer it somehow invisibly into this one. And I was prepared to blow him up and blow myself up, and that's how I decided, well, I'll hit him on his forehead before he has a chance to do anything else. As I did, yes, I managed to hit him. The bomb didn't go off. Perhaps I didn't use the right place. He tottered a little bit, because before I made a few yards, a few steps, he was able to fire after me. And the first bullet passed between my ribs. But I still managed to run away from there. At the same time, I grabbed his cap with a five-cornered staff. Why again, I don't know. But then something was guiding me there. You know, I hit him with one hand, and I grabbed his cap, and he started shouting, "Fascist, fascist," and all others came out running and trying to find me. And I was there crouching in one of the bushes, you know, as far as possible, you know, inside it. They were practically touching me there. They didn't find me, and I stayed there for some time until the hullabaloo sort of quietened down. And then I was near the bridge. I was going to spend the night by the riverbank, but I was wounded. I was bleeding quite profusely. I tried to stop the bleeding, you know, as far as possible, but you can't, because it was the two wounds and, you know, losing a lot of blood. So I said, well, I better go and do something else. And eventually I managed to come to approach the bridge. And much to my disgust, I put that partisan cap on my head. So I presume those who saw me assumed that I was one of them, so they didn't take much notice of me. And so somehow or other I managed to cross the bridge, and the British guards were at the other end, and they also started interrogating one thing. I just lifted my shirt and showed the blood pouring down, and they immediately called their I presume the commanding officer, he was a captain or somebody. He came out and took me to their sort of ambulance post. My wounds were attended to, and I was put on a stretcher. They were just about to take me to the Anglo-American Field Hospital near Udine, when the doors, in fact, I was inside the ambulance car, when the doors opened and two Tito's officers stepped in. One lieutenant, one is a sort of second lieutenant. They heard about this. They heard that somebody's been about, that somebody, you know, fascist or whatever it was, that somebody attacked their guard. In the meantime, I had thrown that cap out of the jeep while I was being taken away to the ambulance. Again, why did it? Because it would have given away straight away, you know, that it was me. I told him, I thought I could speak to him openly. I don't think it was the British captain who denounced me, but obviously they had their spies. You know, the partisans had their men everywhere. You know, they were keeping them informed of every person's move, any undesirable, you know, unknown person. And they started interrogating me again, you know, very thoroughly. And one of them said, "That's him. We got him." But the junior one, who was the second lieutenant, he was a lawyer, so he said, "No, it can't be, because the other one, the other person you're looking for, had breeches, like quite a kind of type of trousers, which were sort of similar type, but they were not breeches, but anyway, in the dark, as it is, you know, so whoever saw me, you know, gave the information, thought, well, he had." So I sort of caught at this, as, you know, as the last straw, and started, "Yes, well, I'm not this," and then, you know, I started pretending that I was even worse than I was. I mean, I was in a pretty bad shape, but you're making it even worse. The English captain was there, ready to start to move off. He was looking at me desperately, and I was looking at him. I said, "For heaven's sake," we spoke some German, "can you tell them, you know, get me out of here as soon as possible?"
You were in Italy at that time, weren't
yes,
you?
Yes, in Italy, yes. On the others, yes, in mm-hmm. Italy. But they were still very much in power there, you see. And they could have taken me and just taken me with them. And I don't think the British captain and guards would have stopped them. I would say, "Oh, it's one of our criminals, and that's it. So keep off." And they probably just let me go. Anyway, well, eventually it said, "All right. Don't go with them, you know, these British people. You don't know what they'll do with you or where they'll take you. They're already showing them, you know, great mistrust. You know, we'll come for you tomorrow and take you back, because you don't want to be with them, because all sorts of things may happen to you." I said, "Yes, I know that. You just let me go now. I mean, I didn't say this. This is what I was thinking." And, well, they left me eventually. We went to Udine, to this Anglo-American field hospital. And I must say, this captain was absolutely marvelous. I'm sorry I haven't got many particulars. You know, perhaps he's still alive. You know, I think I would like to get in touch with him one of the days and say thank you for that. Anyway, he stayed with me until my wounds were dressed and everything was done. I was given a bed and left out and said, "Well, now, you're going..." He said he was going back to his unit. I said, "Well, those two officers will be coming to you and asking for my whereabouts. And they want to take me back." He said, "Don't worry about it. I'm going back to change, and I'm off on my holiday, so I won't be there tomorrow." So that was very reassuring, and I stayed there for a few days, and then I had to be transferred as a civilian. I had to be transferred to another hospital, which was an Italian hospital, and I was there surrounded by all, you know, partisan, the wounded, you know, lame and the massacre, you know, lots of, you know, heavily wounded, without legs, without arms, eyes. Of course, they started suspecting me again that I wasn't one of them, because I didn't share their jubilation, whatever it was. So I had to escape from there in my pajamas. And it's a long story from there. I went to another hospital, and again, I was, you know, being tricked by the British, who were telling me that I was going to go to another hospital, New Zealand hospital. And it was again by sheer chance that I discovered that I was being taken to Trieste. Because, you know, when I was ready to go, I was resisting this. And I said, "No, I don't want to go there anywhere." I didn't trust them. And then the driver who was going to take me, he was coming around looking for me and shouting, "Yugoslav, Yugoslav." And I said, "Now, then, where are you taking me? Where are we going?" And he showed me the paper, said, "You're going to Trieste." So I realized I was being lied to again, because they would have taken me there, and that was in Tito's hands. So I said, no, I'm not going. So I kicked a great deal of fuss about it. Eventually, they let me go. So anyway, the story becomes less important. And I managed to join with some Polish fighters, and through them I managed to get and join the units in who they were then transferred to Forli. So it was sometime in June that I was, you know, some mid-June or whatever it was, that I eventually, you know, got there. And so I was one of the few who survived. And it's quite a fascinating story. You know, it's, I don't think, once you start reading it, I don't think you'll easily put it down.
That's right.
So I have combined here quite happily the, you know, historical background, because in the introductory chapter I describe, as I've showed you, the repatriation, and, you know, from Ostia and what led to it.
Yes.
So I give this historical background, and at the end of it I got this chapter on collaboration, looking at the problem of collaboration. Mm-hmm. Why was such a criminal? What have I done? Why am I an outcast and others who did much worse things at much less cost? And they are the given life peerages and all the possible praise. That kind of, you know, double morality, and I'm afraid that is something I haven't managed to swallow to this day.
Well, I'd like to ask you a lot more about that issue, but I'm wondering, before we go on, do you have any idea of what happened to the group you were being repatriated with, you know, when you made your escape?
Hmm.
Those who didn't escape, have you any idea what
happened?
Oh,
yes, we know that. I mean, I wasn't an eyewitness, but they stayed there, and then from there they were taken to another school, which was used as the base from which people were, you know, again, stripped naked, maltreated, tied, their hands tied with telephone wires at the back, and then two of them also tied to each other, so there would be no chance of escaping. And as such, they were loaded on lorries, which took them a few miles out into the Kochevje forest, and caves, and then just massacred there en masse. And this went on for several days until they were all shot. One or two people managed to escape even from there. One of them crawled from that mass of corpses, but not many people. A few of them managed to escape while they were being taken to the place of execution. A few others managed to escape, en route and so on. And the very first one to escape was Ljotic. I mentioned him before, his own son, his second son. He was with us in a similar position. He escaped through one of the windows of the transfer, you know, the compartment, jumped in the tunnel, you know, and luckily didn't hurt himself. He went back to Viktring, tried to alert the people there of what happened. Nobody believed him. He went to see the commanding officer, Dr. Colonel Krenner, and he wouldn't believe it. And so transport continued to be sent during the next few days. So, yes, I'm afraid that all those people, well, practically all of them, met a sticky end. I understand that children were separated, and they were sent back to their various institutes for re-education. But women were massacred in the same way, so not many survivors there. So we know this, but we know it from people who were there and who saw. And, of course, there are mass graves there now, still waiting to be. I mean, they planted, you know, fair trees around there so that, you know, people wouldn't guess what it is. But at one time, there was so much sort of, you know, chemical fermentation going on there that the soil was heaving up, and in places opening, and the bones were sort of scattered all over the place. So some of them were taken down through the subterranean channels and washed out in various rivers and, you know, pools. But that still remains a mystery because no one is allowed really near the place. So one day, perhaps, like the cut-in murders, we'll be able to explore that. But when? We don't know. At the moment, it doesn't look very promising. So, yes, that was a sad story. But of course, then it didn't stop. Went on till the end of the month when some Red Cross people started, you know, sort of siding with you know, when they were about to send the last contingent of women and children, Slovenian mainly on that occasion. And then, you know, also others came from London to stop this. Alexander came himself to see. But by this time, thousands of people have been sent to their death. And from this camp, I think most people were liquidated. In a few days, they were all, or practically all dead, without trace.
When you came to Britain, you know, and you settled here, did you say anything about this yourself? You know, was it something that you continued to think about or to try to do something about? Or is it, having survived something like that, you try to forget it and go on with your life? I wonder, you know, how you cope with that situation.
Well, I must have. I mean, I can't recollect, you know, quite explicitly what I mean. I know I went around the country and made quite a few speeches, and I spent a year in Bradford, and you know, sometimes 2 or 3 years in Dublin, and a few years in Oxford, and a few months in London. So yes, I must have talked about this, but of course many people wouldn't believe it. They wouldn't believe it, and I don't think people wanted to know this anyway. And you see, you've got to be careful here. You are saying something that wouldn't be very welcome to your hosts. I mean, after all, you're accusing the British Army. You're accusing British officers. They betrayed you. They sent you back. Not many people would believe it, so I'm afraid in many cases it had to be kept more or less inside. Because, I think mainly for this, because not because it's tragic, but because people just wouldn't want to know. I talked more about the communism and the terrors and, you know, and the kind of, you know, dictatorship they have imposed on my unfortunate country. As far as possible, you know, trying to be objective. And yes, give them credit where credit was due. And I must say that, you know, they showed a great deal of dedication. You know, I was talking to you about my college days. And I must mention this because I think it's only fair to mention. I mean, all right, we were anti-communists. We had a different ideology. We were Christians and royalists and peace-loving. But we also loved our pleasures. I remember at that time, with all our struggles as a young man, come weekend or evening, you know, I would go out and take my girlfriend or go out to the cinema, to a dance, and enjoy myself. We took our Christianity for granted. We thought Christianity would look after itself in a way. Our anti-communism would look after itself. Now, what did our communist friends do? On the contrary, they forgot about these pleasures. They spent every time preparing leaflets, working through their cells, going around and distributing leaflets or putting posters. And I'm afraid their dedication reflected very badly on us because they were determined that their cause should be successful. And it turned out that they were right. They believed in it and they were prepared to do something for it. We believed in something, but we were not always quite as dedicated as they were. And here, I think this is one of the reasons why they were so successful in many cases. I know through terror, I know through massacres, I know through intimidation, but also there's a great deal of this quite genuine enthusiasm and the dedication. And I can't forget that. I mean, I go back to those, you know, pre-war days, and I think of them. I said, well, how much more successful would we have been had we shown the same kind of dedication to our particular causes. And I have stressed this every time I have talked with, you know, British audiences about this. And I think excuse me, some people would find it difficult to understand this because it's, you know, it's so out of sorts, isn't it?
I was wondering also, you know, you were saying and explained so well the difficulties of sort of talking to this, particularly about British people.
Mm.
Would it have been when Bethel and Tolstoy wrote their books that you were sort of faced with the issue again? Was that quite an important milestone for you, that British historians were writing about this?
Well, I must confess, I didn't read Bethel's book until very recently. Only a few months ago I read it, so I confess my unconcern. I have read about it. I knew, you know, what roughly happened. Tolstoy's book, again, I think I had read it before Bethel's, you know, because I got in touch with him. Come in then, come in.
I wonder how that impressed you, that a British historian was digging so deeply into this issue and writing about it so that the world would know.
Well, I felt it was high time that something more of the kind was done. Like, it was, you know, well, he was a British historian. He went to the same university. I mean, I think he was at Trinity after me. And I don't remember exactly what years. I was there in sort of 48, 49. He must have been after me. And I felt it was high time that, you know, some of these things were recorded and some of them brought to public notice because it was presented in a documented way, and he is, whatever some critics have said, he is a reliable historian, and I don't think he has said anything deliberately to mislead. He may not be right in every respect, as you said yourself, because a great deal of that is conjecture, and so you can't speak with any certainty, even if you're a historian. I mean, you're making assumptions, you're making conclusions, but they may be based on wrong premises. And in that case, well, are you to blame? Are you to be accused of being subjective? I don't think so, but I think he's done as good work as any historian. I mean, if a J.P. Taylor or people, or Alan Bullock, or people of that caliber, I don't think they could be said to have been more objective. Indeed, I would say that they are more subjective in their presentation. A J.P. Taylor, I mean, he carried such tremendous weight, but a lot of it was very, you know, not based on any substance. It was just, well, his view or his sentiments or... All right, people liked him, and people liked listening to his talks and his deliberations, you know, on the radio or elsewhere. But he's still respected as a very, very great historian and, you know, contributed to historical research.
I notice in the second book, The Minister and the Massacres, that you are mentioned, aren't you? You gave evidence for that book, is that right?
Well, that was when Tolstoy had... I sent him, because I knew that he was working on this, so I sent him the first part, you know, that introductory section there, and the beginning, I think it was the first chapter or two, or was it just those two chapters that I sent him? And anyway, he quoted a couple of pages from there, but it wasn't still published in a book form at that time. The book came out a few. That's why he doesn't give any other references, as he does with other sources. But now, I mean, there's no question of the book coming again. But had it appeared in a second edition, then he would have put that right. So he didn't know the rest of the story as it is there. And I must say, I haven't had very many contacts with him, and I haven't been not as close to him as, say, Vlachovic has been, because they have been, you know, working on this fundraising and similar activities. And we went to one or two seminars in London, the LSE. He was given an account after the, that report that came out.
The Cowgill report.
The Cowgill report, yes. And But what I know of him is mainly based on his writings. And I think I found that very, very enlightening. And I think I quote him in one or two cases, especially towards the end there, because I quote his perhaps unfounded view about NKVD, where he associates Macmillan with that particular activity. How far is that again? We have no evidence. We can't prove it. And unless and until we are given access to those documents, it remains a conjecture. But
I was wondering also about the trial, the recent trial, whether you have any particular feelings about that. You know, this, of course, would have been Lord Aldington, Toby Lowe. And,
well, I felt that he was a thorough cheat and a liar. He was saying things that he knew perfectly well, not right now. He admitted, even at cross-examination, that orders were issued to tell us lies.